The Spectator podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's special election episode, we'll be casting our eye over the two countries heading to the polls in the next couple of months. We'll be taking a look at the UK after Theresa May called a snap election on Tuesday, and then we'll be taking a look at France, who will whittle their presidential field down to two this weekend. First up, much to the surprise of everyone, Theresa May announced a general election this week, to be held on the 8th of June. I'm now joined by James Forsyth, Richard Angel from Progress, and Bobby Duffy from Ipsos to discuss what we can expect and what the result might be. So James, why has she called it now?
Well, I think there's obviously the opinion polls, the fact that she will come back with a bigger majority. But when you talk to people involved in this decision, what they say weighed most heavily on her mind is Brexit, not just the ease of getting Brexit through Parliament, but also the timings of it. They feel that this gives her extra time at the end of the process, because there won't be an election until 2022. She's not going to be kind of butting up against the Article 50 timetable and the electoral timetable. This will give her 3 years from the conclusion of the Article 50 deal before she goes to the country again, which means there's more chance she'll have done the deal on the future trade relationship between the UK and the EU by the time of a general election after next. And also, it makes it easier for there to be what she calls this implementation period. So a few years in which free movement continues, the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice continues to prevent a cliff edge. Because if she had stuck to the existing electoral timetable, she'd have only had a year from the end of the Article 50 process to a general election. And it would have been tricky to go into a general election saying, oh yes, I said Brexit meant Brexit, but free movement's still going on, and we've still got the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But apart from that, it means Brexit. So I think that's why she's done it.
And Bobby, how are the polls looking at the moment?
Well, incredibly strong for the government, for Theresa May. And, you know, echoing what James has said, it just seems like a good thing to do. There's a lot of talk about this being a gamble for Theresa May, but it's hard to see what that gamble is, particularly right now. The polls are showing that she's got a 21-point lead. We're always told, don't look at leads, look at shares. But if you look at the share, it's 45, 46%. And that's the same sort of lead that Margaret Thatcher had in 1983, Tony Blair had in 1997. So the structure of seats right now means that she won't get that kind of landslide. But a six-figure majority seems very possible. And all the calculations that lots of different people are doing are all coming out at low 100. So why wouldn't you take that opportunity with all the context that James describes?
Although, I mean, I suppose recently we've had quite big political upsets. Do you think there's any chance that stuff could backfire for Theresa May?
There's always a chance that something massive happens and things backfire, but it's not the equivalent of a very close 50-50 race for Trump and Clinton. It's not equivalent to a close 50-50 race for Brexit. This is a massive lead. So you can see it closing and getting tighter. You can also see it not getting closer and getting tighter as people learn more about Jeremy Corbyn and see more about Labour's offer, because it seems very disjointed around that key issue of Brexit for people. So, you can see it shortening a bit, but the gamble is tiny.
Richard, how are things looking for Labour? Is it quite bleak?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that James is right. This is not a bringing forward of the 2020 election, but a delaying of the first post-Brexit election. And I think that says quite a lot about the Prime Minister's position. She doesn't have a lot of confidence that she'll get the deal and the kind of motherhood and apple pie that she wants from Brexit, and that is going to leave Britain in a much diminished case, or it's not going to be the hardest of hard Brexits that the kind of UKIP tendency in her party wants. So she's ultimately doing this actually from a point of weakness, not strength, while obviously when you look at the polls, politically she's in a very strong place, but thinking through her future of what she would go to the public on that first post-Brexit election, that's the game that she is playing, and that's why she's having to do it, because she fears being weak at that point. And I suppose the other thing that, I mean, you know, the numbers speak for themselves, and I was warning in the run-up to kind of Ed Miliband trying to become Prime Minister that you've not got much chance if you're behind on leadership and you're behind on the economy. I think we're also behind in a quite significant way on national security that will put in play previous Labour voters that have never thought of going elsewhere than Labour that might do this time, that Labour MPs who have a strong record on whether it's defending Trident or the country or various things that they have done will try and assert over the party's national message. But also Theresa May's, it's a bit cynical, like there's something un-British about kicking the Labour Party when it is so down and out, and I think that might just narrow the polls at least for a little during the campaign.
I think there is a gamble in what she's doing, which is her brand is all that she's a grown-up who doesn't play political games, she just gets on with the job. The risk is that this looks like a political game.
It is one.
But I think the opportunity for her is this. She's got a quite unique moment here. She could reunite the right. She can heal this fracture that Europe has caused on the right. And that is why the Tories have not got over 40% of the vote in the general election since 1987. You know, she can bring those people who drifted off to UKIP because of a Europe issue back into the fold. When you add in the fact that she's quite appealing to that kind of voter, she's a kind of older, more experienced politician who isn't kind of a slick metropolitan Cameron type, you can see how she can reunite the right. And then on the other hand, she's got this opportunity to reach into the Labour heartlands, and the combination of Brexit and Jeremy Corbyn, I think, gives her a chance to convert voters who would never think of voting Tory. And if you look at her, what I would call her kind of third way between kind of nationalism and globalism, her emphasis on helping those who feel that they've been left behind by globalisation and economic change, she's got more of an offer to those voters and more of an appeal to them than any Tory leader this century. So I think you really have got a unique, she has got a unique chance to realign British politics. You know, she might be, she's one thing, she disdains political game playing. She's doing that, but she's actually rather good at it, as her rivals for the Tory leadership contest will tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I think, because even that threat to brand, I think, is more theoretical than real among the public generally, because it's kind of, it is two main factors. Is first, there's a lot of distrust in politicians generally. They know that they're political animals that are making these political calculations. That's not going to come as a surprise to the public. But also, they don't consider it that deeply. And I think they are relatively convinced that this is a good thing for the Brexit process. I mean, the snap polls, you've got to be careful with these very quick polls straight afterwards. But you had, you know, approaching 50% of people saying that it was the right thing to do, and you got people in the teens saying it's the wrong thing to do. I think people do get that line that this actually does help Britain in a much bigger issue for them than the toing and froing within Westminster. So I think even that risk is minor from a Theresa May point of view.
Richard, is there anything that Labour can offer to Brexiteer working class voters at this point?
I think there is lots. I think the fact that Theresa May's got to come back with a deal of some kind or make out that no deal is somehow good. We only focus in what's in the deal because we are trying to retain as much rights for whether it's consumers, workers, or kind of environmental protections. So in that sense, we have the offer that we care about the detail of it, and we've got really brilliant people who are all over it. So whether it's Yvette Cooper at chairing the Home Affairs Select Committee, or Mary Cray on the kind of Environmental Audit Committee, you know, the people who are doing the detail,
but Richard,
are on it, and that's where Labour's got its best people.
Shadow cabinet. This is the problem. You're rather tellingly talking about the election after next. And I completely understand why. But in this election, there is no detail on Brexit yet. We just know what Theresa May aims for. And I think I'm kind of paid to understand this. I have no idea what Labour's position on free movement is, for example, which is going to be a massive issue for lots of people in leave voting Labour seats. And I think there is a real challenge here, which is that when you talk to Tory MPs about Jeremy Corbyn and those involved in planning the Tory election campaign, their biggest worry about Jeremy Corbyn is the idea of him as PM is not a credible threat. In 2015, the Tories could hammer this Ed Miliband propped up by the SNP message, because although I think you were right at the time about the underlying nature of the polls, the headline figures suggested that this was a real possibility. I think it is hard looking at the headline figures right now to think that Jeremy Corbyn might be Prime Minister. I mean, I think back to those kind of personal finance sections in the run-up to the last election. They're all about, how to do your tax planning to avoid Ed Miliband's mansion tax. I don't think anyone is going to be changing their personal finances based on the worry that Jeremy Corbyn might be Prime Minister.
But if you think of the converse of that, in the run-up to 97, one of the reasons why Blair got a massive majority was not only he'd done that work, there was a sense that if you didn't go out and vote for it, you might not get that change. Whereas I think that doesn't really seem to be the prospect.
No, I'm not.
So therefore, what the British people don't want is a one-party state. They do not want Theresa May getting a blank cheque on Brexit. They might want a sense of press on with the next bit, but they do not want her to have a blank cheque. And they have got some brilliant Labour MPs who have either... Yeah, if you're a Labour MP right now, you have done it against the odds from 2010, you've done it against the odds in 2015, or you came in one of those elections, which is really means the public are kind of... and have kept you there. So I think it... In that sense, our Labour MPs are where the hope is. And the fact that some of those bigger picture things aren't in question means that in certain seats around the country, in 232 of them, they can have their kind of, is my MP really good at standing up for my area, and the detail of this stuff going forward. And that's where I think you might get not as much change as the top level figures suggest.
Let's talk about the Lib Dems, because they're now back in the spotlight. James, you suggested that there's going to be a realignment on the right. Do you think there's also about to be a realignment in the centre ground?
I think the one party who've got nothing to lose and everything to gain in this election are the Liberal Democrats. They are trying to turn themselves into the UKIP of the 48%. And, you know, they've only got 9 MPs now. And I think I'd be very surprised if they didn't more than double that, and maybe even make more than 9 gains off both Labour and the Tories. Because they have a clear Brexit position in this election. If you are a Remainer who is horrified by what is happening, vote Liberal Democrat. And you look at lots of the seats the Tories won off the Lib Dems last time round, Bath, Cheltenham, Twickenham, they all voted quite heavily to remain. So they've got an obvious calling card there. And then the other thing I would say is, look at the SNP's success in Scotland at the last election. You know, 40-odd% doesn't win you a referendum, but in a parliamentary seat, it's quite a large number. So in some of those West Country seats, even ones that voted kind of 55-45 to leave, the Liberal Democrats have a chance. I think one of the ironies here is that when Theresa May was in the hustings for the Tory leadership, one of her big pitches to Tory MPs was, I'm unlike Boris Johnson, I'm not flirting with an early election, because I've had to fight the Lib Dems in my seat, and I know how hard it is to get rid of them. In a way, she has opened the door to them coming back in British politics. Richard might be right about how individual Labour MPs can try and hold on, but I think you will see Liberal Democrats trying to appeal to new Labour voters in lots of seats, saying, look, if you really want to stop Brexit or soften Brexit, look, we're the people to vote for. Corbyn can't lead, won't lead, we will.
Bobby, do you think this election could be the death knell for UKIP? Are they now redundant?
I don't think redundant entirely. I mean, obviously they've lost their main purpose, but you do see that most countries keep that kind of immigration-focused party at the sort of level that UKIP are at now. So in terms of vote share, you can see them sticking around the 10% point going forward, but not having MPs. I mean, that I think they're going to really struggle to get a single MP into Parliament, but staying as that kind of husk of a vote, not disappearing entirely, but as a force, as a political force, it's difficult to see what they're going to change next, what their purpose is beyond that.
Theresa May has also said she's not going to be doing TV debates. Do you think this election is going to have a slightly different feel to the referendum and also the 2015 election?
Yes. I mean, I think David Cameron had a certain combination of pride and a kind of reluctance to completely stick two fingers up to the broadcasters. Theresa May and Lyndon Crosby in combination don't have any such qualms. And so, you know, Wallace Cameron kind of didn't want to do the TV debates but spent months trying to pretend that he did, and they were just negotiating over the details, etc. Theresa May's just come out and said, I'm not doing that. And I think we will see that attitude from her very clearly. She's not going to budge from that. I also think this is a bit like kind of Jose Mourinho's Chelsea. They're not going to try and win this in spectacular, free-flowing fashion. They are just going to go for the biggest win that they can in an organised, disciplined way. And I do think this, you know, it is quite remarkable to call an early election and manage to catch kind of everyone in the media completely and utterly off guard.
And a massive advantage as well. None of the speculation, none of that. You think back to 2007 and Gordon Brown and the mess that was of the to-ing and fro-ing. They just set it off on the wrong foot for the whole thing. But this is just so clean. It's just kind of gone. Very impressive.
Just finally, if Labour does have a crushing defeat, do you think that spells the end for Jeremy Corbyn?
You would hope that the Labour Party wouldn't cling on to failure yet again, but who knows?
I think one of the worries I would have if I was a Labour moderate is, if the press really do go for Corbyn over, you know, all the kind of genuinely surprising stuff in his past, you know, the courting of the IRA while they were killing British soldiers, calling Hamas and Hezbollah friends, I mean, the danger is that might make the kind of new membership of the Labour Party feel that kind of Corbyn is a martyr, he's been unfairly treated, and kind of lead to some surge in support for him. I think there are two reasons why non-Labour voters should hope that the Labour Party returns to sanity after this election, which is, first of all, you know, you need a proper functioning opposition. And secondly, if there is going to be another second Scottish independence referendum, which you can't rule out, a revived Labour Party, I think, is that kind of crucial to the union winning that. because you need to be able to say to voters in Scotland, hang on a second, look, this is not going to be ruled by the Tories forever. Mm. And, you know, the Tories will win seats in Scotland this time around. But having a kind of credible Labour Party to suggest that you're not going to be stuck in a one-party state in Britain, I think is actually very important to the unionist cause in Scotland.
Yeah, no, I hope so as well. Because it's kind of that realignment point of having a new centrist party, a new centrist grouping, just doesn't happen very easily or at all and takes forever. And we don't need that right now with the changes that we're going to be seeing anyway.
Also, the country could do with a Labour government. It would do some really great things. Like, there is a whole series of ways in which the Tories are setting us back. And I thought that the Prime Minister's interview on the Today programme was probably the poorest post having called an election today interview that I've ever heard. And actually, if you go back and study, but she's better than, for some people, competence-wise, than what the alternative is. And that's what they'll look at. And it is a travesty to see what is happening, that we seem to have the B team running all of the parties. And that's going to make this a very worrying election.
Yeah, but interestingly, it does look from the polls, though, that Theresa May is substantially, you know, more popular than David Cameron was.
Yeah, she is. And Jeremy Corbyn is at record low levels. Yeah. I mean, the gap is just extraordinary for going into 6-7 weeks away from an election. The gap on leadership competence is extraordinary.
That, am I right in thinking that the scary thing for Labour is that it's not because he's unknown?
Exactly.
That's very
people important. Have a very clear image of him, whether that's the correct image or not. We'll wait to see. They will learn more. I mean, he has lots of complaints, justified in many ways, about not getting much media oxygen on his stories and policies. But will that help him when you actually get more of that? And I think it definitely is true that the Conservatives have laid off him for quite a long time. The right-wing media have laid off him for quite a long time. That will change significantly now. And, yeah, I get Richard's point about, or your point, James, about whether that actually increases sympathy in some ways. People kick against that if it goes too far, but they've got so much to work with that
I think you'll see as well with the absence of TV debates is Corbyn running the first few weeks of this election campaign like one of his leadership elections. So urban areas, big rallies, you know, excitable speeches with excitable people outside, and they'll convince people that that means that somehow the polls are wrong, because the polls have always been wrong, because they always overestimate Labour support, or the Democrats' support. But they will have some short-term shot in the arms that convince them that somehow it's that there's some big conspiracy against them. This campaign won't totally look normally for the first few weeks.
That was James Forsyth, Bobby Duffy and Richard Angel.
If you've always wanted to start a wine cellar, 2017 could be the perfect time. Barry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit all tastes and budgets. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, onto a more immediate election, France's. This weekend, the first round of voting takes place, but in this week's issue, Jonathan Miller says the rivals for the French presidency offer crooked competence at best and economic meltdown at worst. I'm now joined by Jonathan Fenby, the author of The History of Modern France, and the historian Aline Florence Manon. So Jonathan, in Jonathan Miller's piece, he suggests that the mood in France at the moment is one of what he calls weary resignation and disgust. Do you think that seems a fair assessment?
Well, the resignation, the weary, the morosité, as it's called, has been there for a long time. I remember first writing about it 20 years ago and so on. And it's built up. And successive elections, we've had presidents elected promising to change everything and to make it better, and they don't, basically. So, yes, there's an air in that sense of resignation, of weariness. The question, I think, this year, which has been very interesting, is whether that is actually translating, finally, to a shake-up of the political landscape, with the Socialist Party more or less having imploded and likely to finish fifth in the presidential poll, and two of the four leading candidates coming from outside the regular political establishment. So it's a time for change.
Aline Florence, what's the most likely outcome this weekend?
Oh, I mean, I think nobody could predict this, so I'm not going to venture into predicting a result. But just on the wariness, if I may add a point, is that what is also striking is that on the one hand, yes, we have this sort of gloom mood that is palpable even from London, but there's also something else going on, and that's maybe not as visible, which is also the vibrancy that actually also exists among French voters, that they are interested, they are reading, they are listening to the candidates, to the debates, they are exchanging, debating. for instance, Emmanuel Macron's movement En Marche, I think, recorded that they had over 14,000 applications to be invested by En Marche for the upcoming election to the National Assembly. So that means there is really a vibrant civil society that is interested in politics.
Yes, and indeed, I mean, you've seen that En Marche, which is only, what, a year and a bit old. When it began, I was in Paris just after it was launched, and I was kind of almost kidnapped on the boulevard in the 13th arrondissement by young people who were urging me to sign up for En Marche. When I pointed out that I wasn't actually French and couldn't vote, they said, oh, well, chez vous in Belgium, you can work for us, and so on. They took me for a Belgian, that's fine. No, so you've had that, and then the hard left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, was given, you know, single figures only a couple of months ago and so on, and has now come up in the latest poll to 19%. The crowds that Mélenchon attracts, and indeed that Macron attracted in Paris, Bercy, last weekend, this is a very enthusiastic following. So as I say, you've got this long resignation, but there seems to be a kind of reaction against it.
Macron seems slightly confused there about what he's offering to French voters. What are his policies?
Well, your article describes him as like kind of chocolates with a soft centre and so on. He's promising reform, of course. He's promising to cut down on the public sector, on civil service, but only by natural wastage of people retiring. He's promising to be a good European and to relaunch the euro, possibly with a European budget minister. He's promising a lot of nice-sounding things, calculated, I think, to appeal to a broad centre. And one of the ironies of this is that you've got Macron, who's the most insurgent, the newest of the candidates, who actually, in many ways, represents the last throw of the establishment against the extremes of left and right.
I mean, he's certainly the youngest candidate and poised to become probably the youngest president in the history of the Fifth Republic, but I don't think that he is at all confused about what he's proposing. I also don't think that he is actually making grand promises, and that maybe why he has reached a glass ceiling in terms of attracting undecided French voters, that actually he is quite frankly acknowledging, you know, his limits, acknowledging that we cannot do everything we might want to do, but that maybe there is some value in moderation and in recognizing also that we may fall short in practice, in political practice, of our own normative ideals.
And the other candidate worth keeping an eye on this weekend is François Fillon. Has he recovered from the scandal that clouded the campaign earlier this year?
Yeah, well, of course, the scandal was about his Welsh wife, who was paid a lot of money for doing work, which she appears not to have done. If you speak to the Fillon people, he's around 19.5% in the polls at the moment. If you speak to Fillon's people, they say, there's a big kind of secret Fillon vote there, people who won't tell pollsters that they're going to vote for him. And he's certainly, you know, plugging in there very strongly. The margins are so small because we have the latest poll, we have Mélenchon on 19, Fillon on 19.5, Le Pen on 22.5, and Macron on 23%, with about 35% of people saying they haven't made up their minds how they're going to vote. So, you know, the possibility, the potential for the unexpected swing to the extremes of left and right is still there.
And do you think we could see that, a fight between Mélenchon and Le Pen in the second round?
Myself, no, but as you were saying, one has to be very careful of this. I mean, I still think we're going to get Macron against Le Pen, probably, in the second round. But what you have to acknowledge is how the political landscape has changed and how you can now, for the first time, see a roadmap for Le Pen to get to the Élysée Palace, even on the second round, although Macron's given as the big winner there. But if there was a very low turnout, which makes her committed voters weigh for more. If the left decides we don't like Macron, ex-investment banker, etc., etc., we're not going to put up with him. And if Fillon's right-wing voters in the provinces hold their noses and go for Le Pen, you could see how Le Pen could put together a majority. I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, and I think, but also what it might decide this election, or actually the whether or not people are going to go to vote. So those who haven't yet made up their mind whether they are going to take time off their Sunday to actually go to vote. And
yes.
You know, it's hard to, if you don't believe in any of the candidates, why bother? And if, you know, the message that they are getting from following the news and the campaigns is that they're all corrupt and hypocritical, and it's, you know, Fillon, Macron, Hamon, Mélenchon is kind of all the same, then why vote? So I think like really the election now is in like the capacity of the candidates more to mobilize these voters, the abstention, the potential abstentionists, than necessarily convincing the voters who have already decided they were going to vote for Mélenchon or for Le Pen to vote for one of the mainstream candidates.
I suppose it's also striking that Mélenchon and Le Pen are both running on anti-EU tickets, but both on the left and the right. What do you think that means for French politics?
Well, they are. They both are committed to getting out of the euro, holding a referendum on a Frexit. But it's noticeable, particularly for Le Pen, that her programme has 114 points in it, and there's very little space for Europe in it. And she knows, and Mélenchon knows too, that according to the polls, if polls are accurate there, I think 68% of French people want to stay in the EU, and indeed in the euro, which, strange enough, in some polls is more popular than the EU itself, go figure. But so actually an anti-EU campaign in France would not work as Brexit did here. So I think we shouldn't look at the French election through the kind of Brexit lens.
Just finally, if France does end up with either Macron or Fillon, do you think for the 2022 election it will push France even more to the extreme with regards to voting?
Not necessarily. So I think probably if Macron is elected, there is a good hope, I think the strongest hope for France to actually recover and reform its institutions also in a way that may prevent that in the future. If Fillon is elected, I think it will be more difficult because he will not have the clear mandate to actually pass these difficult reforms or even his campaign promises, because he will still just be elected with, you know, roughly 20% of voters in the first round. So it will be very difficult to pass these reforms to have the legitimacy to avoid sort of France being paralyzed by strikes and demonstrations, as is often the case. So because Macron would potentially be able to have a broader majority, or at least some compromise, readiness to compromise between members of the PS and Les Républicains, there may be hope there, but you know, we may be disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, Fillon, you know, there was always a basic contradiction in his programme, because on the one hand, the bulk of his electorate, and how he got the nomination from the Republicans, was from conservative, Catholic, rural, older voters, let's say. But his programme, and he presents himself as, I am Francis Thatcher. I'm going to cut 500,000 public sector jobs. I'm going to go back within the 3% deficit thing. Well, when that rather old, conservative, rural electorate finds that healthcare is being cut, that their grandchildren don't have schools, etc., etc., you know, they're not going to be very happy, I think. So there is a basic contradiction there. But as you were just saying, the interesting thing, I think, out of this in the kind of long... Of course, it's very interesting who's going to be in the Elysee on May the 7th. But the other question is whether we're going to see a reconfiguration of French politics, which has been held back again and again and again, really since Mitterrand, so that you get Macron presiding over the Social Democrat wing of the Socialist Party, which risks implosion in any case, the centrists and the liberal wing of the Republicans, Alain Juppé, who didn't run this time. His speech saying why he wasn't going to run in place of Fillon was almost saying, come on, Macron, you know, we need big radical change from the centre-right and so on. So you could see that coming together, but presiding over that kind of coalition will take all the skills of Monsieur Macron and his backers.
Well, and it will take, obviously, the willingness of, you know, the losers to accept, you know, their defeat with dignity and humility and actually, you know, try to work together instead of, you know, being embittered by their loss.
And at the same time, what you'll have, I mean, going for that, you'll have the Mélenchon people on one hand and Le Pen's people on the other side, with the CGT union particularly, which has been losing a lot of ground but has become very more militant as a result of that to try to get support. You know, you'll face an awful lot of in-the-street opposition, not necessarily parliamentary opposition, but it'll make ruling very difficult for Macron, even more so for Le Pen, I mean, who I think just couldn't rule. And of course, if Le Pen wins, you'll have a lot of the country against her on kind of old and ideological grounds. And interestingly, she's been catering more and more to her core supporters over the last week, as if she realises she's got to keep them for the next time round. But you'll also have huge capital flight from France going on, bond yields soaring with German bonds and so on and so on. And that will be a pretty chaotic situation.
That was Jonathan Femby and Aline Florence Manon. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including our books podcast, where this week Sam Leith discusses boarding schools with Alex Renton and Yacenda Maxtone Graham. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as more election analysis from Nick Cohen, Rod Liddell and Hugo Rifkin. And we have a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.